You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, April 28th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Kyle Reismandel, senior university lecturer and interim director of law, technology, and culture program at the Federated Department of History at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. On his book, Neighborhood of Fear, Suburban Crisis in American Culture, 1995 to 2001. Meanwhile, Joe Biden, to address the nation tonight for the first time, rolling out the second of the infrastructure bills. This one, a $1.8 trillion plan, including 2 years of free community college, free universal pre-K, paid family and medical leave, and $1.5 trillion in raised taxes on the wealthy. Missing from tonight's speech, expansion of Medicare, an increase of the estate tax. Meanwhile, the CDC says vaccinated people no longer need masks outdoors in non-crowded venues. Biden's looking to increase IRS funding for a near 9-to-1 return. Independent autopsy shows that Andrew Brown died from a shot in the back of the head. The Department of Justice has launched a probe of that police department. U.S. Navy fires warning shots at Iranians in the Persian Gulf. New York Post reporter resigns over the false Kamala Harris book story. NBC News poll, Joe Biden seen as more moderate than Barack Obama. Wonder why that might be. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is Wednesday. Joining me as always, Emma Vigilin. Emma, how are you?
I am well. How are you?
I am, enjoying the nicest day of spring, although yesterday was in competition, and also the obligatory allergic reaction that I'm getting in part to all the things blooming right now.
Well, you've introduced me to the wonders of Zyrtec, so
there you go.
Not even an ad.
Not even
Zyrtec,
an ad.
Effective, yep. Thus far for me, at least.
Glad to hear it. Yesterday, the CDC, and I had thought they wouldn't do this for another couple of weeks, but they announced yesterday that vaccinated people no longer need to wear masks outdoors as long as they're in a non-crowded situation. Like, you're not at a concert or you're not in wherever crowds, maybe a baseball game, but they're spreading people out at baseball games.
I don't even think they say baseball games. I think it's basically, even though that probably would be fine, but since you're sitting sort of with clusters of people, you're probably not going to a baseball game alone. I think it's more like, if you're going for a run or something.
Right. Yeah. Well, if you're going for a run, certainly if you're walking around, you're fine. And so there are, specific crowded areas where they say no. And, there is, of course, some measure of hesitancy. You see things that are like what are happening in, for instance, in India. there's every reason to believe that the vaccines are incredibly effective. The of the millions of people in this country who have received a vaccination, there's only a single digit thousands who have had what they call breakthrough infections. And even in those instances, there are very, very few instances of serious COVID cases and ones that would lead to death. However, you're dealing with a pandemic. And so if you're going to err on the side of anything, it is caution. Who could possibly argue against that? Who could possibly argue that fundamentally your life is altered in such a detrimental way that if you continue to wear a mask at, let's say, an outdoor concert where there are tens of thousands of people around you, that it is so costly, the opportunity cost is so great, that this is a grave mistake? Well, apparently, most of those people who feel that way are either working at Fox News or at some other conservative quote unquote news outlet. Here's a clip yesterday from Dagan McDowell. I don't know who she is. She's on Fox and Five or The Five or whatever it is. And they make the announcement a couple hours before she says this. And it's clear she woke up in the morning with, I know what my bit's going to be today on the Fox Five. Oh, darn it. They have actually relaxed the mask mandate for vaccinated people. Well, forget it. I'm still going with exactly what I had this morning, even though I know that they have actually done this.
Get rid of them. Let them get. Are they going to be Neanderthals too? Absolutely. The only thing that's going to come out of this announcement today is surely some left-wing lunatics are going to start picking fights with people who are out in the street, not wearing masks. They're, you know, the self-appointed shame police, the screeching pod people. Demanding proof of your vaccine. It's going to be a nightmare in New York.
I would recommend that Dagan watch a network called Fox News. Should be easy. They probably run it there at Fox News. And she looks at the primetime television program that they featured the night before, where their host, Tucker Carlson, spent an extended period of time telling people that if your child is forced to wear a mask at school, you should approach it as if a teacher had beaten that child. If you see someone who is wearing a mask, you should go up and tell them to take it off as you're walking around. She is accusing a hypothetical pod person of doing exactly what Tucker Carlson had done the night before to millions and millions of people. And understand, there are people who are going to be wearing masks out there. They're going to be children who maybe are immunocompromised. Maybe they have some other disease. Maybe they have cancer.
That maybe they feel like they're doing their patriotic duty or their duty to society, and that makes that child feel like they have a sense of purpose and feels good.
Whatever it is. But the idea that these people are going to be harassed now by Tucker Carlson followers for not being as cavalier as they have been is absurd. We have over 550,000 people, probably more, have died in this country of this disease. And some people can't get the vaccinations because of, like I say, the immunocompromised. And the idea that they're going to get harassed. But Fox needs to make this an issue because it's just not sticking. There needs to be some type of agreement. In fact, our guest today is going to be talking about this dynamic. It's fascinating.
Well, let me just say, though, I mean, you said that maybe she could take a listen to their top cable host, Tucker Carlson, because he, you know, performed all of that shaming last night that she says that liberals are going to do the conservatives. But I would counter that it seems like she's watching him thoroughly because she's just using his exact same. everyone on this network who's trying to be somebody is quite pathetic. They're just recycling Tucker talking points, repackaging them for themselves, and then maybe, you know, lazily using what their producers prepare for them as spin. This is the new way that the right is moving, and everybody in Fox is trying to get on the bandwagon.
Oh, Emma, if that was true, then this morning on Fox and Friends, you would have heard the same thing. If what you're saying was true.
What?
Great point. If you want me to get the vaccine, give me an incentive to get the vaccine. And that is to take off these freaking masks that everyone's so tired of. And I think the reason he didn't come out, he came out with the mask, is he wants to say, oh, the big reveal, no more masks, let's throw it away. But people around the country are saying, we've been doing this already. Thanks, Mr. President. We've already been doing this.
Anthony Fauci's.
He literally just did that. He just did that. They didn't even change their talking points after Biden's address.
The hilarious part about this is, A, she's vaccinated. So she 100%. Doesn't need. So somehow she was able to find an incentive to vaccinate. And then she's saying that, like, oh, the idea that he's taking off his mask is also wrong. And people have already done it. Well, if people have already done it, then what is the incentive to get the vaccine, according to her? Like, this is all just, I mean, it really is stunning. And if the implications of this hadn't already killed literally tens, hundreds of thousands of people, and conceivably kill hundreds or thousands, you know, in the future, maybe a couple of thousand people, it would be hilarious, but it is just, it's just disturbing. I mean, it's just completely disturbing. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Kyle Reismandel about the neighborhood of fear, suburban crisis in American culture in 1995 to 2001, which really explains a lot as to how we got here today. This one piece of breaking news, the New York Times has just reported that federal investigators have executed a search warrant at Rudy Giuliani's apartment. Prosecutors obtained the warrant as part of an investigation into whether Giuliani broke lobbying laws as President Trump's personal lawyer. I can't even imagine that America's mayor would do something like that. I won't believe it at all.
He's just too wholesome for that.
In the meantime, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. Folks, Mother's Day, it's a week away. What? Well, a little more than a week. You got a little bit of time. What have you gotten for Mother's Day? Emma, have you thought about this?
I had like a pre-sleep anxiety thought about it. Like, God damn it, I need to get something for Mother's Day.
I've got your gift right here. You ready?
Yeah.
A bidet for your mom.
Mm-hmm.
You can bring your mom into the future with a brand new Hello Tushy 3.0 modern bidet attachment. It's stylish. It's eco-friendly. It's super easy to install. And it's going to help her stop flushing her retirement down the toilet in toilet paper costs. But frankly, it is just the most civilized way. It's not that, you know, the idea of is not particularly new. The idea that washing yourself with water is the cleanest, is the most effective way to wash yourself. Well, Hello Tushy doesn't just cleanse your butt with a precise stream of water. It cleans itself too. And it does so before and after it's used with the Smart Spray automatic self-cleaning nozzle. And when they say that anybody can put this together, anybody can. It is super easy. All you got to do is basically unscrew your toilet seat. You screw into the existing plumbing. You don't need any new electricity. You can see the plumbing behind the toilet right there. Super easy. They have a 60-day risk-free money-back guarantee. They have a 12-month warranty. And if your mom already got one back in the days when we just had the classic Hello Tushy, well, she can upgrade to a new Hello Tushy 3.0. So check it out, folks. It will really, I mean, I don't want to say it's going to dramatically change your life, but it's going to dramatically change a part of your life for the much better. And now you can give that as a gift. Give the gift of a clean butt. Go to HelloTushy.com/majority to get 10% off plus free shipping. Special offer for our listeners, HelloTushy.com/majority for 10% off. HelloTushy.com/majority. Folks, I said this yesterday, actually. I've been talking about Harry's for a long time. I don't shave that often, but when I do, it's with my Harry's razor. I gotta remember what the name of it is. Mine has got the chrome handle that is it's really good, sort of like a classic look. It's nice. It actually feels nice in your hand. Like I'm like beginning to appreciate like style and design more as I get older. But I also have to say that the selling point for Harry's for me is that I get a great shave, and I do so for a lot less than I would pay with those other razors. $2 per refill. Harry's bought a German razor blade factory. They've been making blades for 100 years. Their design team combined that weighted ergonomic handle with a textured grip and a flex hinge. It's a smart, simple razor designed for delivering a close shave all along the contours of your face. And they totally stand behind the quality of their blades. They have a 100% money-back guarantee on harrys.com. For me, it is the handle, sort of the classic, the feel of it, but the look of it, and, of course, the narrower shave blades, which work with my asymmetrical nostrils. I found out that I had I have a deviated septum.
You going to correct
that's
it?
All about. I never knew that, but I went to ear, nose, and throat. But that's not the point.
I feel like a lot of people do, and then they figure it out. And yeah.
I had no idea. And so, to a certain extent, I was cued into that because I became more conscious of my shaving and because of Harry's slimmer razor blade. So I'm not crediting with Harry's to be able to determine whether you have a deviated septum. But for a limited time, Harry's has made their exclusive offer even better for listeners of the show. New customers can get a special offer in a Harry starter set and body wash at harrys.com/majority. You're going to get that 5-blade razor. You're going to get the weighted Truman handle, foaming shave gel, a blade cover, and a travel size body wash, which I've been using a lot of that body wash lately. I mean, it's not to imply that I've never used soap before, but.
Well, yeah. Well, that's true, though.
There's never been a better time to try Harry's. Go to harrys.com/majority to redeem your offer today. And lastly, folks, what would you do with some extra money? What would you do with some extra time? What more would you want besides extra time and extra money? Well, you can get that by cutting down on your chasing down postage or being able to basically waiting in line at the post office. I recommend to you, way to save time and money, shop online at stamps.com. Stamps.com allows you to mail and ship at any time, anywhere. You get that postage right from your computer. You can send letters. You can ship packages. You can pay a lot less with discounted rates from the U.S. Postal Service and the UPS and more. Stamps.com has saved businesses thousands of hours and tons of money. It's a must-have. If you have a small business and you're sending stuff out, it's a no-brainer, complete no-brainer. With Stamps.com, you can use your computer to print out official U.S. postage 24/7 for any letter, any package, any class of mail, anywhere you want. And all you got to do is you just either drop it off or you schedule a pickup. Stamps.com, you get discounts of up to 40% off office post office rates and 62% off UPS shipping rates. It is no wonder that nearly 1 million small businesses already use Stamps.com. So stop wasting time going to the post office. Go to stamps.com instead. There's no risk. With my promo code Majority Report, you get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage. And you're ready for this? Digital scale. No long-term commitments, no long-term contracts. Just go to stamps.com. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage. Type in Majority Report at stamps.com. Promo code Majority Report, stamps.com. You will never have to leave your place again. All right. Let's welcome to the show Kyle Riesemandel. He is a senior university lecturer and interim director of law and technology and culture program at the Federated Department of History at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. His new book, Neighborhood of Fear, Suburban Crisis in American Culture, 1995 to 2001. Kyle, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
How's it going, guys? Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
So, okay, let's just start with the most obvious question. Why 1995 to 2001? Like, I get a sense as to why 2001 is the end point. Why is, why? Excuse me, 1975. Why is 1975 the beginning point?
So there's a couple of reasons. One is, as you probably are aware, growing up in America, sort of the idea of the kind of post-war suburb, the Levittowns of the world, right, emerges after World War II. They're built and people move in this first big wave, right, through the 1960s. We see massive suburbanization and sprawl. And by the 1970s, there is a sort of second and third generations of people moving in, and they're moving in with expectations, right? They've grown up with Leave It to Beaver. They sort of understand the suburbs to be these white spaces, these safe spaces, places where, you know, they have control over the government and the school board. And when they move, they start to find these local fears, these new dangers they weren't expecting. And so 75 is kind of a rough date, but it's really the early to mid 1970s when you start to see sort of more visibly things like toxic waste and environmental danger. You start to see a growing fear of crime on the streets and eventually kidnapping and burglary, and the emergence of the culture wars and the fears around popular culture and morality. And so the other part of it is that the broader culture is shifting to make those threats visible. You know, the sort of rightward turn in politics and culture is happening over that same period. So just as these threats emerge, right, you're drinking water or you're afraid of Dungeons and Dragons or heavy metal, the culture is telling you to also be scared.
So okay, I want to just go back to, like, I'm just trying to think of, like, the early 70s and what generates, and well, maybe let me ask you this first. How do these things emerge? Like, I mean, why are these things new, or they're just more attention being paid to them? Or is there a context that is developing in this country that is doing one or the other of those two things?
So it's some of column A, some column B. So for example, right, the discovery of toxic waste at Love Canal, and the idea that your suburban community could be built on top of a toxic waste site and that it could be seeping into your groundwater and giving your children any manner of diseases. So that's a real new thing that is happening.
And we should say, I didn't mean to interject, but yeah. So just people know, that's just a couple of years after the EPA is established. And so right. these new fears that these new dangers have always been, or at least in this context, been present. It's just that now we have apparatus to actually find them.
Exactly. And so this is the way in which sort of the dangers themselves emerge as visible, right? That you're able to, in some sense, see them because politicians, popular culture, activists, and other people are saying these are actually dangerous to you. And some of these things are actually happening, right? There's a kernel of truth. So people really are getting sick at Love Canal. And so you can plausibly say in your neighborhood, not in my backyard, right? I don't want this thing here. I'm going to get sick. My family's going to be sick. My neighborhood will be sick. I don't care where you put it. And right. And quite often, you know what happens then, right? It's sort of that generates the eco-justice movement. But similarly with kidnapping, right? The kidnapping and murder of Adam Walsh in 1981 sort of recode suburban public space as fundamentally dangerous to children, right? The thing that you could assume your children could ride their bikes, walk home from school. Now you're saying, oh my God, we have to have their fingerprints, know what they wear every day. We're afraid of the white van, right? This kind of mythic white van. And that's also because of the wars on crime and drugs, right? There's this massive reorientation of culture towards crime and punishment. And so people are ready to see crime. And when one happens, right, they extrapolate from the sort of one or small number of examples.
I guess you move towards the crime aspect, which I want to explore as well. But I'm curious about kind of the dogmatic adherence to the heterosexual nuclear family structure, mm-hmm. and how that plays into the psychology behind this as well.
So again, you're pointing exactly to sort of this formation of the suburbs in the 1950s and 60s. and this focus on sort of producing citizens, right, and producing consumers through the nuclear family, which is an invention of post-war America, right? This is sort of aberrant, really, in the history of people, but also in the history of America. And this focus, you know, and it's usually through the lens of the Cold War during that earlier period, is then by the 1970s, what you have emerging are the gay rights movement, second wave feminism, and the broader move around sex and gender rights. And so what happens is there's a backlash, right? And as you know, right, the ERA is defeated, but there's a broader idea shared on both the left and the right that the family is in danger, that the nuclear family itself, because of divorce, because of these rights movements, and because of a larger liberalization of popular culture, that this family is under assault. And so you see by the 1980s, right, the backlash of the culture warriors, and that's on both sides, right? Again, you sort of have the Pat Robertsons and the religious right, moral majority, but you also have, you know, the sort of middle of the road Democrats like Al Gore and Bill Clinton, right, fighting these exact same wars. And what they're trying to do, and I think you're right, is ultimately reinstantiate this kind of vision of basically white, middle-class, suburban, straight people as the kind of ultimate goal of American society. And this is what the culture wars are really about.
How much does, when we talk about something like Adam Walsh, how much does the advent of cable television I'm just trying to remember, you know, we're talking about the early 80s, and there was at one point, I mean, this is when I was a kid and a teenager. There was the media expanded essentially. Mm-hmm. And so there is a hunger for the stories. Like, obviously, I mean, I think you're right in there, you know, at the time of Adam Walsh, there had been, you know, a half a dozen, black kids in,
more than
I think
that,
it was in Atlanta alone who had, been, but nobody knew about it. That plays into racial issues, but it's also a function of like, how, you know, what the media decides to promote, what they need to mm-hmm. sell. And so how much of that is also at play here?
Yeah, so the political economy of media is essential to this story. You're 100% right. Because of what stories get told and how they get told matters to how people imagine their world. So one of the reasons my book focuses on news media and popular culture is, one, it's sort of understudied in this way, but two, this is how people make sense of these threats. This is how they make sense of who they are and where they are in the world, right? How they're communicated to. And so the emergence of cable television, I think to some degree, the sort of emergence of talk radio a little bit later, right? Particularly right-wing talk radio. I know you're well aware of that emergence. It allows people to sort of access these fears more easily, more regularly, right? So it's not just that this idea is out there, you hear about it, but that it quite literally is on the movie screen, the television screen, the newspaper, and the magazine, kind of all simultaneously, right? In addition to the sort of government and school structure things that are reinforcing the ideas of these threats. So that is definitely part of it. There's actually probably a book to be written from some media studies perspective or communications perspective about that exact thing.
How did the, and there's a couple other, like the, and I want to get to this notion of productive victimization in a moment, mm-hmm. but I want to sort of just like get more like the context here, because, sure. And I guess maybe this happens a little bit further into the 80s. But the scare about, and this is, I guess, wrapped up also in Adam Walsh, the scare of like, of pedophilia, of yeah. Satanism at, you know, daycare centers. Mm-hmm. The 80s are so loaded with what's going on in the politics at the time, because, you know, I've read a couple of different folks who have written that what drove that scares of Satanism at childcare centers was an anxiety from the religious right in losing mm-hmm. the patriarchal nuclear family. And if moms could drop off the kids at daycare, who knows what they're going to be able to do next, go out and get a job. I mean, so how much of that is going on here too?
No, that's exactly right. So most scholars of sort of sex and gender, gay rights, histories of the family would basically say you're correct, right? That by the 1980s, the backlash against these rights movements of marginalized peoples, particularly women, centers on the family, because the family is a place in which you can plausibly say the destruction of the family is the destruction of America, right? So this is a political cudgel that is swung mostly by Republicans at that moment, but becomes sort of a central and I think kind of unifying issue, frankly, by the 1990s for both political parties. But you can safely say if the family is in danger, we have to do these things. And we have to really promote that danger. We have to find that danger. And so those fears are often around children, right? If you want to do something in America, say, what about the children? And so daycare centers, walking home from school, babysitters, and then ultimately, right, the kind of mixing in of the sort of Judeo-Christian worldview, the fear of Satanism or kind of cults, right? Which, of course, become, again, there's a kernel of truth, right? There is a greater visibility of cults and satanic and non sort of Western religious belief, right? But it doesn't mean they're out there, you know, drinking the blood of babies, et cetera, right? But they reason from these kind of maybe one plausible example to all these other things you're talking about.
Well, I mean, I'm reminded of, I know this is in the 90s, but the West Memphis Three, right? I mean, I don't know how much that played into what you wrote about, but that is such a moment that informs the dynamics that Sam's talking about. I just, before we move a little further, I wanted to just go back a little bit because I know the book starts in 75. I've been reading a lot about the 60s recently and just how there's just this confluence of change and movements and inflection points. Mm-hmm. And you have obviously the civil rights movement, but also the free love movement, which challenges that heterosexual dogma that I referenced earlier. And then there's this complete, I guess, backlash almost where the suburban life becomes even more entrenched, and there's like, I guess, a kind of religious adherence to it almost when, and so I don't know if your book explores this, but I'd be curious about your thoughts about how the kind of upheaval of the 60s swung the pendulum back potentially to create some of the dynamics over the next few decades.
Yeah, I mean, what you're hitting at is sort of these big picture histories of post-war America, right, are about those swings, right? So throughout the 50s and 60s, there is already a rising conservative movement, largely a grassroots movement, right? So the nomination of Barry Goldwater for president in 1964 becomes kind of the signpost, right, and the election of Ronald Reagan as governor in 1966 in California. But it's in reaction to this, what you're talking about, right? Sort of what they would frame as the liberalization of culture, that popular culture, media is more pornographic, more violent, more explicit. And political culture is saying everybody's equal. Everybody, you know, that white people are being victimized now, right? That civil rights is victimizing white people by making people equal, that feminism is victimizing men by making women equal, et cetera. So the reactions to those things, right, shape exactly what you're saying. Those big picture things that happen and become really kind of mainstream by the 1970s are what I'm talking about in the book, is that the suburbs become the place where this happens, where people are able to look at that politics and see themselves as victimized, despite the fact that they have privilege and power. They're able to see, right, the quote unquote decline of Western civilization, right, as Penelope Spheeris puts it in her documentary about hardcore punk, that these kids represent the failure of families and we need to do something, right? But what they do, and I think this is maybe the part that you're implying, is we don't turn to government, we don't turn to social programs or social welfare, we turn to individualism and families. We say, it is up to you to fix this. And in fact, government getting involved is a bad thing, which leaves behind, right, millions and millions of people without that option. It doesn't really address the causes of teen suicide, teen pregnancy, you know, the kinds of things that are actual social problems.
I wasn't making that point, but thank you for making that point sound smarter than it was.
No, I think you were, because I suspect, anyway, you know, in the back of your mind is the Reagan Revolution and what we kind of the era we've all lived through, right, that those politics have dominated our lives. So it's hard not to have them, at least in your brain, connected, right?
Well, there's about a half a dozen things I want to address in that answer that you gave. But before we get there, I mean, I just want to also sort of get some clarity as to who we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Is it enough to say these are people in the suburbs, or are they a political class, an economic class? And how, you know, do they identify as an economic class, or do they perceive themselves as a political class or a social class and sort of submerge their economic class? Like who are they, A, on those three, through those three lenses, and B, who do they think they are? How do they self-identify?
So the self-identification part is more straightforward. And I think this will probably drive with maybe your own upbringing, your own understanding of these politics, which is they see themselves, suburban homeowners see themselves as sort of non-ideological, right? They don't see themselves as true believers in a cause or a political party or any one of these movements, be it the Christian right movement, the anti-tax movement, or environmentalism on the left. They see those things as empowering them, right? Allowing them to do things. But I care about environmentalism as far as my neighborhood goes, right? I care about the satanic panic as far as my child can walk home and back from school. But I'm not out there for the most part at protests. I'm not, you know, and that's not saying nobody did, but the large majority see themselves as sort of, you know, outside of politics in that way, right? Despite whoever they may vote for at the national level. Lily Geisler,
is it that they look at politics as something that happens in the cities at that point on some level? Like the close proximity is where people actually care about this stuff. And to the extent that we can sort of like pick out of a basket and where to apply it, we'll use it, but we don't really have any sort of greater commitment to a specific cause outside of like, I want my neighborhood to be nice.
I think it's a function of privilege that they see politics as for them and doing what they need rather than them doing something for politicians or politics, right? And so that power and privilege and expectation is often borne out. You know, the privatization of policing, for example, that happens because the local police let it happen, right? That doesn't happen, right, in urban neighborhoods. They are surveilled and policed quite strictly, as we know. So I would say that they don't imagine their world to be political because they have privilege, right? That's sort of the definition of it, right? They don't have to actually engage in kind of these fundamental grassroots activist things, except, as you point out, when they encroach on their actual neighborhoods or their sense of their power or belonging. And he asked a number of other questions of like, who are they actually? And I think ultimately they are kind of the prime example of property owners, right, in post-war America, that they see themselves through that lens and also function that way. And that with property comes a set of rights. And those rights are, you know, when they are mitigated or even threatened in some way, they now push back even harder.
Where does the idea of, because I know that we can in present day, there's a couple of examples present day where I think, you know, sort of some of this, you know, sort of resonates on some level. Like the thing I kept thinking about was as I was reading some of your stuff was the fear that of, I think it was folks in Minnesota had in their lake houses, that the caravan was going to take their lake houses, the caravan that was in Central America. Mm-hmm, and I just thought like that, like, this era that you're talking about is which developed the muscle memory for those people to be able to say like, well, I know they're in the caravan and they're down in Mexico, but they could come and take the lake house.
Mm-hmm.
That's the muscle memory, right? That we're talking about. It's the same thing with the couple with the guns.
Yep.
And the Black Lives Matter, right? How much of it was racialized at that time in the suburbs?
So race is, you know, for a lot of the history of the suburbs, race is sort of central and visible, meaning that the ways in which people asserted their property rights and thought about their spaces was through the lens of preventing integration or at least sort of mitigating integration. As you get into the 1970s, it gets more sophisticated. It doesn't mean that race goes away. It becomes the kind of ever-present thing in all the discourses, but not always as visible. So the tax revolt, for example, is really in some sense about where government, how government works and where government money goes, and a rejection of government money, tax money going to urban centers rather than suburbanites who are generating this revenue, right? And so it's always racialized. We can't talk about the suburbs without thinking about them as primarily white spaces and imagine through the lens of whiteness and white privilege. So all those examples you point out, right, underneath them and sometimes explicitly within them is some sense of white privilege. Even as suburbs have diversified, right, it still remains a centrally white space and premised on a sort of white privilege.
I'm reminded of, I guess, the housing fight in Yonkers in the late 80s and 90s, mm-hmm, I know, just because that was such a confluence of events, and it had to do with housing, and particularly, you know, this is a white space. We have white people over here and Black people over there. And because of, I guess, I think it was national laws, housing projects had to be built in different areas. And there was like this extreme fight there. So I'm just curious about your perspective on I guess, housing projects and how that influenced a lot of the dynamics that you explored in the book.
Yeah. So as you're probably aware of, given our current sort of housing shortage in a certain sense, affordable housing shortage, not housing shortage, and the battles over, you know, what were originally called sort of public housing or the projects, and then eventually affordable housing as sort of vouchers and other sort of market-based things. Again, it's sort of this evolution from, in the 1960s, there were towns that literally passed laws that says you cannot build a housing project in our town, right? So, you know, if you, the state of Michigan, want to build housing projects, or you're going to fund Detroit, and we live on the edge of Detroit in this kind of quasi-suburban neighborhood, we're not going to allow that. By the time we get our fair housing laws in the late 1960s, some states already had them, it becomes a more complicated issue. But this is where the turn, and to some degree, the leveraging of civil rights language by white people and white homeowners to say, this is the tyranny of the government, right? Telling me who I have to live next to. I don't care who they are, right? I don't care if they're Hispanic or Black. I'm not racist,
right.
But, right, I'm not going to live in a neighborhood that devalues the value of my house. I'm not going to live in a neighborhood where my school doesn't get the resources it needs, right? The coded language of race, but also the kind of culture of the community argument that you hear quite a bit, that's both, that kind of springs out of this environmental worldview, actually, right? That it starts with, oh, I don't want a trash dump, but then it's like, well, I don't want an AIDS clinic, or I don't want a rehab center or a halfway house, right? That these are kind of environmental in the kind of biggest possible sense, like, you know, it, my drinking water, but also the culture of where I live, that function with these kind of racial assumptions at their core that go back, you know, as old as the country.
What of the, you know, I mentioned, and we are going to get to the concept of productive victimization, and also on that tyranny of government, because that also plays into that sort of like the contradictions in the way that they approach government. But before we do, one other question, and I know this was a movie, and I think it was at that time, but I feel like I heard the story even before that as like some type of like scary story. Like, I wonder, the development of the sort of explosion in guns, the sort of attachment to the Second Amendment, and the idea of arming myself in the suburbs. How much of that was a function? I just remember that movie, and I don't know when it was from, but I imagine it was from the 80s, where the calls coming from inside the house.
Yeah, yeah.
And that story was out and around before the movie was made, if I remember correctly. And it was just like, you know, one of the horror stories. Like, how much did like the genre of horror and the sort of like, how much did that reflect this sense of like, you're not safe, even in the places where you think you are, even when like your kids go out and they, and then all of a sudden the guy shows up with the chainsaw.
I mean, that is the essence of the neighborhood of fear, right? That is the fundamental idea, is the place that was a safe haven, the place you're going to, right, to protect your family, you know, get all the privileges of suburban living, which is in some sense the privileges of American culture, are actually endangered in all these ways you'd never imagined. And they're now apparent to you. And they're apparent to you in the sort of real ways you might think about dangers of crime or you know, environmental pollution, but also in popular culture, that they're being reproduced constantly around you as prevalent and, you know, essentially mortal, right? That, you know, whether it's Freddy Krueger, who is a, you know, was originally imagined as a child molester, who the parents gang up and burn alive, right? In revenge because the police won't do anything. Or the Adam Walsh story that leads to this massive reorientation of suburban space around security, the emergence of the home security market in response to the quote unquote bucolic burglary wave, right? That crime is inching its way in and it will find you, right? All of these things are empowering people to act. And this is happening, I think you rightly point out, Sam, at the same moment that the NRA shifts, right? So the NRA shifts in 1976, they elect a new president who says, the NRA is no longer about training people to use firearms, right? Or about education, or about some notion of kind of hunting, right? The kind of old, much older, you know, extremely old notion of what the NRA did, to we are a political advocacy organization for gun ownership. And we're going to fight rules against gun, you know, limiting gun ownership. And so they're happening at the same time. You don't see the discourse of the NRA so much in the culture, this, at least the things I'm talking about, until the 1990s.
Right. That's when George Herbert Walker Bush said, I'm getting rid of my NRA membership because of Wayne LaPierre. I mean, this is the migration of the NRA's sort of pond, if you will, from rural to suburban. Right. I mean, that's what's happening there.
No, absolutely. And there's kind of an ambivalence at first around gun ownership with suburban living, right? Because guns actually represent or are symbolic of this violence you're trying to escape or you think you're protecting yourself from. So the endorsement or embrace of gun ownership or the idea of gun ownership in the suburbs takes longer. And in fact, it only kind of comes back, I would argue, only comes around when it's made into this kind of existential political issue that's tied into these broader ideas about government, right? There's this great Family Ties episode from 83 where, the dad buys a gun because they've been burglarized. And so the episode starts with them, this, bump in the night, we're all scared, or they come home and everything's disheveled. They go to a neighborhood watch meeting, and the neighborhood watch is like, we can't stop this. It's just going to happen to us. They have a cop there who says, no matter what you do, this will probably happen to you. So you should just accept it. He's like, well, I'll buy a gun, right? Buys the gun, brings it home. First night he has it. Alex comes home late from a party. Steven goes to get the gun, walks downstairs, almost shoots his son, right? And, and remember, the story of the show is there are these like hippies.
Yeah, I wish
to
remind
right?
people, Kyle, yeah. You and I are dating ourselves. this is Alex B. Keaton was.
I should have given.
It's basically two hippies whose son is a sort of like conservative, sweater vest wearing. I am sad to say. there you go. And then they have a daughter, like two. He's got two sisters, Mallory, and I can't remember the youngest
Jennifer.
One. Jennifer, and they seem to be apolitical, more just sort of like, but it's the parents and the kid. It's the reverse of what happened in the 60s, right?
The show? I'm sorry. Family Ties. That's Family Ties. Okay, yes. I know that.
It's kind of the reverse of All in the Family, right? So the Archie Bunker is this arch conservative reactionary, and his daughter and her husband are the kind of hippie liberals.
Right. And so that's fascinating. It's also sort of like I've wondered about that show. Like, what was the political message that was coming through? Because the parents did seem to be sort of feckless in this idea of hippie punching and the idea of this is a rough and tumble world, which is sort of like Alex P. Keaton's thing. And so they landed on the government cannot save you here. You need to have a gun type of situation.
Well, and so at the end, he says, we don't need a gun, but there's this. So I guess what I'm getting at is there's like this ambivalence about sort of gun culture, I think at the beginning or sort of that early period, 76 to the mid 80s, even as Ronald Reagan is the first to speak at the NRA and endorse the NRA, right? After passing the strictest gun restriction law ever in 1968 as governor. And I can let you guess why, right? Because of the Black Panthers.
Black Panthers, right?
But part of what I'm getting at is that show sort of epitomizes this political expediency idea, right? That at some level, the commitment to these broader ideological things, maybe that they were raised with or whatever, is silly and childish. Even Alex, right? That he's this kind of arch conservative committed to these ideas no matter what. But he's also a young person who's seen as kind of naive and silly. But the parents sort of understand we do what we have to do because what's most important is this household and these people. And everything is seen through that prism. And so the neighborhood of fear emerges when people like that, who would otherwise be, George McGovern supporters or Michael Dukakis supporters or something, right? Actually embrace this culture of fear.
And we've been describing it, but deploy the term productive victimization here, because this is what it basically allows, right? There's a two-step here. And frankly, this is what I think conservatism has become on some level. It seems to me is like, this is the mental process that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Explain it to us.
Yeah. So, and I would agree, and I'll maybe start at the end, which is the reason it's become so central is because it works, right? That victimization as a claim is extremely powerful in American culture. And frankly, suburbanites and even the right wing learned it from the civil rights movement, who were making legitimate claims of victimization, right? Like violence, murder, being kept out of resources, et cetera, right? Everyone understands sort of why that was. And so they see this and understand that if we can make a plausible argument for victimization by, right, the government or someone else, then we can do stuff. We get things, right? And so the way I articulate in the book is that when people move to the suburbs, they find these fears, as we've talked about, right, that they didn't expect. But in reaction to them, they don't just say, like, we need help or we need to protect our homes. They try to do those things and expand their power. They say, we can actually do stuff, right? I can keep things out of my neighborhood by saying they're going to endanger the environment, even if they will not. I can make the white suburban family the center of American culture in response to this satanic threat. I can be empowered as a parent to do all of these things with my kids. I can privatize security, right? I can control my home and neighborhood with the help of government and corporations, right? In a way that I couldn't before, or I didn't even think to do before without the quote unquote legitimate threat of burglary, home invasion, rape, et cetera. And they're, of course, they are, you know, the idea of the book is that they're fueling and fueled by the rightward turn, right? They are the perfect example of this ideology at work, right? That localism, individualism, family, right, is the most important part of America. And by doing that, right, they promote the idea that people are in danger, that we need this politics of law and order or just say no or family values.
You say localism there, and that's just such an, I feel like, a precise term that describes so much of what's just inherent in American culture from its founding, right? Which is this kind of atomization. Mm. And I don't agree with that, but it's something that I think pairs along or works parallel with individualism. And there's that dynamic. It's so difficult to fight. But I'm curious about your thoughts there, because I think it informs so much of modern or historical conservatism in this country as well.
So, you know, there's Lewis Mumford is a historian and sort of urban theorist you may have heard of. You know, he says the suburbs were a collective effort to live a private life. And that idea, I think, is what you're talking about. Because one of the things that has happened because of the triumph of localism and individualism and the idea of sort of what we now call neoliberalism, right, that markets determine social goods, not sort of collectivism or government, is that we've erased the past of communitarianism, right? We've erased actually the memory or history of working together or thinking of our communities in this way. You know, imagine the world where Hillary Clinton says it takes a village and is mercilessly mocked as just like sort of an out of touch liberal where families are centered, right? But that was actually how things worked, right? Again, this kind of nuclear family is aberrant. It is so unique to this period. It is not part of American history or history, right? Sort of writ large of humanity. So part of what happens is you erase this history that you could rely on to make these arguments. And I think this is one other thing I want to make clear, Sam, before you ask your question, is the idea of this mythic family from the 1950s, the idea of these pure cultural values, the idea of the home as safe, are political values that get trotted out to do things by politicians as well, right? They need that story, right? A myth is just a political story. It's something that allows you to do work. And they need that story to do the things you're talking about, right? To reinforce localism, to say, well, we don't need affordable housing because the people in this neighborhood decided they don't need it, right? They've zoned it so you can only have single family homes because the local people should decide, right? Like there shouldn't be any infringement on their property rights and their sort of local decision-making.
Well, that is also a framework that was established, right, with states' rights, right? Like the modality, I guess, was established to basically say, hey, you can't tell us what to do with our black people, you know, 200 years ago, 150 years ago. And that modality carries through to like, you know, we're just going to take care of our own here and we have no relationship. And just as you were saying that, too, I was remembering the Reagan era was so focused on this sentimentality of the 50s. Mm-hmm. And whenever I think of the 50s, I think of Leave It to Beaver and, you know, Father Knows Best. And that's basically Absolutely. It. White picket fence. And that's it. End of story. So let's go forward. So you end in 2001 because all of a sudden we are in a completely different era in terms of fear. And maybe in some respects, I think like over the past couple of years, we're out of that era in some respects, mm-hmm. but we have vestiges, Stand Your Ground, King of the Castle laws. Mm-hmm. Where does that fear in the suburbs, how does it manifest itself today? And has that bifurcated? Has the hegemony of those fears broken apart in some way?
It's tough to say. So I think what I addressed the first part first, meaning the legacy of the production of criminal threat, particularly in the suburbs, is that it results in productive victimization through controlling of space and people, that homeowners direct both governmental resources, corporate resources, and individual resources toward their own protection. And see that protection, see that control as an essential right of home ownership. So you don't get the stuff that's happened now without that being a premise of home ownership, And that's really established through the prism of law and order, you know, tough on crime politics, and then the privatization of policing through actual private police, neighborhood watch, home security systems, et cetera. So all of those manifestations we're seeing today happened because of that earlier stuff in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So it's hard to say now, they've almost become self-justifying, right? That you don't really even need the kernel of truth about crime or about threat. What you need is to have the apparatus that reminds you that right. threats are possible.
Right. Right.
The sign of threat is a threat. And so, you know, Ring, Nextdoor, Citizen, all of these things, right? People are just surveilling themselves, right? I call it in the book, the carceral suburb. You become a jailer and the jailed. And by being in jail, you see yourself as endangered, right? That you're trying to protect yourself in this kind of locked up castle. And so all of this stuff sort of justifies itself, that we're on here constantly, you know, talking to our neighbors about the strange person who drove through, the delivery guy who threw the package, the thing that moved across the night, I couldn't see what it was. And it doesn't require any sort of connection to a material shared reality.
Is there an inherent, has it always been so in this country that there is an inherent need for some, and maybe this is just human nature, an inherent need for some outside fear? I mean, because I'm just thinking, like, now as we talk about this, like, you know, the way that it's migrated to, you know, the vaccination, or to, you know, like, they're putting the 3G in there, or, you know, that we have, you know, less and less a capacity or ability, I should say, to assess what is a real thing that we should be afraid of and what is a fake thing that we should be afraid of. And it's almost like, as long as we have that, that impulse satiated, that we found something to be afraid of. I mean, you know, just everything you're saying about, like, the home, you know, alarm system, like, I'm like, you just get a home alarm system. You don't even assess whether, like, do I really need a home alarm system? Like, I think most people probably never even arm it. They probably, you know, just have it and then they don't use it because, like, well, nobody, there's no, you know, crime's at an all-time low, essentially. I mean, short of the pandemic, it's maybe mm-hmm. changed things a little bit. But in terms of this era, it's at an all-time low, at least in my lifetime.
So one of the things you're pointing out is my research shows, and I think the larger research of criminal justice shows, that home alarm systems do almost nothing to prevent crime. And in fact, the overwhelming majority, something like 90% of alarm trippings are accidental, right? So I read about this story of one suburb in Connecticut where they started fining people in Connecticut, in this town, Mulford, Connecticut, 1983, because they were going off so often and every house had one, the police were only responding to, right? And of course, the police had nothing else to do, mind you. Right. So that idea is certainly true. I guess I would say, so one of the things I try to do as a historian is to stay grounded in some time and place, because the search for sort of universal truths about humanity or people is elusive ultimately, right? Like, it being that we can only know what we know. So I would say, if you ground us in America in this context, right, the reason we have those threats and the continuation of the sense of those threats is that it allows people to do stuff, right? That it is productive. When it stops being productive, we will find another way to do it. But it's productive because of this big picture cultural politics that's still everywhere, right? It's in schools, it's in homeownership, it's in, you know, environmentalism, and it's in national politics. So when it stops being productive, people will stop imagining themselves these way. But if you have the camera and you have the neighborhood watch and you own a gun, right? You can always plausibly say, I did everything I could to protect myself, and yet I was victimized. And so I need to do more, right? I'm a legitimate victim of this system.
It's interesting that to the extent that there's a change, you know, at one point we had this sort of red scare, right? Like, like the country was afraid that there was spies everywhere and communists. And the best I can say for that is at least it was collective. Right. As opposed to, like, I mean, I'm like, but it does feel like the even that impulse, if that impulse exists with humans, that even that was sort of privatized in some fashion.
I mean, I guess I would argue that this is also collective, right? That I think this is still pervasively shared across what people might identify as their political party or ideological beliefs. I think these are things that are ever present because of the work they do. it allows people to do stuff, to make claims, to have political power and have legitimacy in making those arguments. And often, right, to then actually impose their political or ideological view, whatever that might be. And again, this happens often at the local level, right? Because it's much easier to run the levers and shifts of government there than it is, you know, in the broad picture of the federal government or something.
Well, Kyle Riesmandel, senior university lecturer and interim director of the Law, Technology, and Culture Program at the Federated Department of History at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. That is quite a title.
Let's go, but, New Jersey.
Are you from Jersey, Emma?
Yes.
Where are you from?
Essex County.
Oh, I live in Montclair. Speaking of.
There you go.
I will tell you later where I'm from. Not on air. Yeah.
Neighborhood of Fear.
Yes.
The book is Neighborhood of Fear, Suburban Crisis in American Culture, 1975 to 2001. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Kyle, thank you so much for your time. They really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break and we'll be back in just a moment to land this thing. Fascinating look at a phenomenon. And I'm curious as to, you know, it would be interesting to put a class lens on that as well. I mean, it's clearly when we're talking about this move to the suburbs, it's obviously predominantly a white phenomenon, but it would also be interesting to see how class-based that is. We will have to wait for that version of the book. But it was fun to take a walk down memory lane for me. Family Ties. I mean, you know, when I think about it, like all the shows during the 80s were, and it still happens today, but it's actually a little bit more of a vestige. It was very, very family oriented. Not necessarily it was suitable for families, but it was all around the family. And
I think that's why people kind of like Bob's a little bit.
Without a doubt. Bob's Burgers, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Without a doubt. In fact, that was that was one of the shifts they made. In fact, we could talk about this in the fun half, was to make that more family oriented, because we're out of time today. Emma, we will see everybody tomorrow.
Yeah.
And we'll see the rest of you today. I'll finish that story about Bob's. So Bob's Burgers, the creator of Bob's Burgers, Lauren Bouchard, he had been making stuff for Adult Swim on the Cartoon Network. And so his sensibility was to be darker, right? That was what was happening during that era. And he had done, did a pilot, I think it, ran, I don't, I think it aired, Lucy, Daughter of the Devil. I think that maybe went, and it was just basically centered around, you know, it was sort of family oriented, but you know, the dad was the devil. And so you'd run into all the things that you would imagine a teenage girl would, if their father was a Satan. And then there was another show he did called Saddle Rash. That was a Western. And I think I was the lead on that, one of them, where I was it was all voiced, a gunslinger who had no arms. And so that was a little bit of a challenge, as you would imagine, surviving in the West as a gunslinger without any hands or arms. And so when he did Bob's Burgers, the premise of the show, if people remember the pilot, and I doubt anyone does, it was 10 years ago. Hugo, the health inspector, which my character, uh-huh. Had suspicions about Bob's Burgers when they opened, that they were serving human beings, that their burgers were actually made out of humans, that they were cannibals. And
let me just say here, my girlfriend is a huge Bob's Burgers fan. She watches it to fall asleep. So I've seen a lot of it now. The pilot is a completely different show. The sense of the jokes are way, they push the line way more. I was shocked watching it because we'd been watching like the recent ones and it's like, okay, we'll just cycle back because basically she leaves it running as she falls asleep. And it's like Ren and Stimpy almost. Like,
yeah, it was much edgier yeah. at the time. And they were literally, you don't have to go away, Matt, just because you say that one thing, he goes away.
I know, but I always love like what compels you to turn on the camera, because you talk with the camera off, but like it's such a treat when you turn it on.
Well, I like to make the appearances count, but also I have fiber now. So I just got fiber optic installed. So
so excited. So in the first episode, Hugo thought they were cannibals, and they were. The show was originally written that the family were cannibals and their burgers were made out of human flesh. And so I'm thinking at that time, I am golden, because this is going to mean like I am playing the guy who chased the Hulk, the reporter. And in the series, The Hulk, there was a reporter. And by the like season four, they would just have him show up in the last 30 seconds of the show to remind everybody that there was this tension that the Hulk has to keep running. And I'm thinking like, I'm going to be that character. Like, I'm going to have to do by season three or four, I'm just going to like show up and go like, I wonder what they're up to. And that's it. And then I get paid my session fee and I get the residuals, because that's all I've done, because you just need that tension. They're going to get found out as cannibals. And the biggest note that Fox had when they bought the show was like, let's just get rid of the cannibalism and they're just a family. And then I was like, well, wait a second, but where does that put Hugo? And eventually it basically, you know, once a season, twice a season type of situation. And so that's the sad story of how, and Larry Murphy, who was also like a side character, he just pushed it. So now he's a regular. But if we really want to, Hugo's replacing Jimmy Pesto's, that's something that people think about. I'm not going to push that, but I mean, that would be great.
Be great if the hashtag organically got started for that, I imagine.
I mean, if it was an organic thing where it's like, instead of Jimmy Pesto's, how about Hugo's Place or something like that? It fits pretty well. I've already gone through that, but that's, that's neither here nor there. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that keeps this show going. Look at that. Look at now what we have. Matt with his fiber. You know, there's going to be more fiber Matt. In here, just a reminder, your support keeps this show, makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the free show, free of commercials, and you get the fun half. amquickie.com. Check out the new Discord at majoritydiscord.com. And don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Make sure you tune in to Nomi's show today. YouTube.com/TheNomaKey Show. Check that out. Or twitch.tv/the_NomaKey, Nomi Key Show. I supposedly said it right yesterday, and somebody said that she said I said it wrong.
I feel like she's almost met. Like, I thought you said it right too.
It's gaslighting. She's gaslighting.
She's gaslighting, right.
Yeah. Yep. And join us today on the fun half, Brandon Sutton. Brandon, tell us what's happening on the next discourse.
Well, in the next discourse, we're going to be catching up on all things COVID related, you know, as usual, you know, archiving/documenting this terrible time. I'm sorry if I sound a little nasally myself. I'm getting over a sinus infection. So
I feel like I got one too.
So you gave it to me, is what you're saying.
It's possible.
Via Zoom, that technology is improving.
Do you think it's allergies?
I think it's allergies. I think that, you know, I'm notorious about not taking care of my allergies and not being, you know, preemptive in the Claritin or, you know, whatever the antihistamine usage. And just every year it hits me.
Well, there you go. Well, we share that. I've got the, like, sort of what the past couple of days felt like a sinus infection.
You know, we're like brothers, Sam. You can tell if we have similar styles of fashion and glasses.
We actually do have similar styles of fashion. I think that's probably true. That's not nothing to brag about. So I'm afraid for both of us. But
that's why I didn't sound excited, Sam.
Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning with your fancy background screen?
Yeah, everybody, what's happened with Left Reckoning is everyone's going to subscribe to the YouTube channel. Tomorrow night, we have Ben Burgess on talking about his book, Canceling Comedians While the World Burns, which is going to be a little bit controversial, I can sense already, but I'm ready for it. And I actually really enjoyed the book. I read it all last night. So tomorrow night, 8 Eastern, Left Reckoning YouTube channel, go subscribe to that, folks. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning if you want to pay us for it.
A lively discussion with Ben about this. I'm going to be tuning in for sure.
That's a wild setup Matt has over there. It's like he's on the bridge of the, you know, USS Enterprise.
Is that like a gaming chair, Matt?
It is a gaming chair. Yeah, it's not even like one.
I was tepid because I don't know what a gaming chair is. It looks like pretty
comfortable.
Spaceship.
Is that comfortable?
Yeah.
You know, it's, I kind of cheaped out, and this plastic arm thing sucks after a while. It's not very nice in the elbows, but other than that, it's a okay chair.
My keyboard doesn't glow like that.
Oh yeah, I got the very loud keyboard too.
Wow.
See you folks in the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number.
RM for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. And the alpha males are back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a man.
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dannerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dannerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them.
What
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black. African. And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I
have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on! What? Come on! What? Come on! Really? Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am in total
pussy,
total,
pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy.